We have a right to fight for our country, the same as every other American.
The new movie Red Tails is based on the true story of the Tuskegee Airmen, but one chapter of history the movie didn't have time to cover is a courageous stand for equality known as the Freeman Field Mutiny. Hear that history from someone who lived it Saturday on Hometown Heroes.
We had to fight in the first place for the right to fight.
I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join me for Hometown Heroes Saturday at 1 on News Talk 580, and now airing Saturdays at 5 on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes. Glad you're with us this fine Saturday, whether you're listening to us on News Talk 580 KMJ, maybe FM 105.9, or online anytime at kmjnow.com. If you've heard the program before, you know it's about honoring our aging veterans for their service and their sacrifice, preserving their stories for their families and for the rest of us, too, so we won't forget the price that has been paid for our freedom. That's a price that continues to be accounted for each and every day by our men and women in uniform. And as we do all that, hopefully we learn a little bit, not just about history, but about patriotism, about courage, and sometimes just about life. Even though we generally hop in a time machine and go back to the 1940s pretty much every week, I think you're going to find the program today pretty current. The number two movie at the box office last weekend was Red Tails, the new film that Modesto native George Lucas put together to tell the story of the Tuskegee Airmen. We're going to get to that and the Tuskegee Airman, who will join us. But first, just a little update on the topic of last week's show, when 94-year-old Frank Avery was describing the tragic plane crash he survived in 1946. We talked about the Fresno native who was killed in that crash, Marshall Tetzstahl. As it turns out, both of Tetzstahl's sisters are still living, one of them right here in Fresno. His widow is also in Fresno, and they are now in touch with Frank, as well as family members of other victims of that plane crash. Really neat and fulfilling to see that connection made. If the family so desires, I might share some more of that story at sometime in the future. Today, though, with Red Tails selling out theaters, it is the perfect opportunity to focus on those trailblazing African Americans serving in what was still a segregated U.S. military in World War II. We've heard from members of bomber crews on this show, guys who said they were so grateful for the fighter escorts they had, courtesy of the Tuskegee Airmen, the 332nd Fighter Group, or as those bomber crews knew them, the Red-Tailed Angels. Let's go ahead and listen now to a little bit of the trailer for this movie.
We have a right to fight for our country, the same as every other American. We will not go away.
I can't afford the kind of losses my bombers have been suffering.
Can you help save lives?
If you get us new planes, we can help your boys.
Nothing's difficult.
Everything's a challenge.
Through adversity to the stars.
From the last plane to the last bullet to the last minute to the last man, we fight.
We fight.
We fight.
We fight.
We fight.
We fight.
At all costs, we protect the heavies.
Fighters, 4 o'clock, stay with the bombers.
One bomber, that's 10 men. We count our victories by the bombers we get to their targets. By the husbands we return to their wives. By the fathers we get back to their children.
Yes, sir!
Boy, that really gets your adrenaline pumping, doesn't it? If you haven't seen the film yet, it is in theaters everywhere. It's rated PG-13 because of some language and, of course, some violence. It is, after all, a war movie. What it is not is a documentary. Look up the film Double Victory if that's what you're after. But Red Tails does, in an entertaining way, educate people about the important role that the Tuskegee Airmen played in the air war in Europe. There's another element of history that the film didn't really have time to flesh out, but we will on today's show in our conversation with Mitch Higginbotham. I want to welcome him in now. He's 90 years old, lives in Dana Point, California, and many years ago when I started this program, the very first guest I had was a guy named Augie Macaluso from Sewickley, Pennsylvania. He told me he had a friend who was a Tuskegee Airman. So I've had this gentleman on my list for a long time. Perfect timing with the release of Red Tails. Mitch, welcome to the program. And first of all, as someone who lived some of the history that this film depicts, What is your take on the film Red Tails, and do you feel like it did justice to the story it's trying to tell?
Yes, I do, and I think it was a marvelous motion picture, but some people were under the impression it would be a completely historical account as a documentary. It was a dramatic production, and it was based on the experiences of Tuskegee Airmen, 450 fighter pilots participated in the war in Europe from 1943 to April of 1945. That's when the war, of course, in Europe ended.
Absolutely, and I've had many a member of a bomber crew on this program talk about how grateful they were for the support of the Red-Tailed Angels, the Tuskegee Airmen who were flying and protecting those bomber squadrons back in Europe. But I've never had a chance to talk to someone who was in the outfit and involved in all that training in Tuskegee, Alabama. You have a very unique story to tell as well, and I want to go back early on. You grew up in Sewickley, Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh.
Yes, I did.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Do you remember where you were when you heard that Pearl Harbor had been attacked?
Yes, I do. In 1940, I was working at the steel mill and across the river from my where I lived, planning to return to college to finish my last year. And then, of course, when Pearl Harbor struck, then right shortly thereafter, I had already registered for the draft. I was told by one of the World War One veterans that if I wanted to fly, was interested in special services, it would behoove me to volunteer. So my father and I registered for the draft at the same time. It was interesting at the draft board there in this little town. We were in different rooms. They registered him as white and registered me as Negro.
How did that happen?
Well, his hair was a little straighter, and he might have been a fraction of a shade lighter than me. So they just assumed he was white, and I was black. So
wow.
That was quite interesting. I went to Pittsburgh and took the aviation cadet exam about February of 1942. And after I passed that exam, then they told me, I'd be notified.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I went on and on, and I wasn't notified. So I said, well, gee, I'll just take a trip to New York and then to Washington, D.C., and stay in Washington, D.C. with my aunties and wait for the call. So I did so, and no call. And finally, I ran out of money for my separation pay from the steel mill, and I had to find a job. So I was able to obtain a job as a special policeman in Washington, D.C., and I worked as a guard in the federal buildings up and down Constitution Avenue. That included the Federal Trade Commission, the Department of Archives, Department of Justice, Department of Agriculture, and so forth. I happened to have been with the first blacks to sit down and eat a meal in the cafeteria at the Department of Justice, of all places, in the spring of 1942. Finally, I was advised that instructors were needed down in Tuskegee, Alabama. That was there had been a lot of, five or six black schools where they had initiated what they call the CPT, the Civilian Pilot Training Program.
Right.
That was initiated in about 1939 because in anticipation of an eventual war and the need for a trained Air Corps.
Mm-hmm.
So they called me to go there to Tuskegee to participate in the civilian pilot training program, and that was learning to fly so that I might be able to teach the aviation cadets in their first phase of training. It was called primary training.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all black instructors in the primary phase of training closer to the campus of Tuskegee Institute. And then they had upper and lower primary, and then if you were able to complete that, then you went over to the military base, which was about 7-8 miles away. There you took this next phase of training, was basic, upper and lower basic. If you passed that, then you went into advanced, upper and lower advanced. And upon completing that, then you were awarded your wings and your commission.
Mm-hmm.
So I went through this civilian training program, and when I completed all phases of that program, I was ready to begin instructing in the air. I had the opportunity to help some of the Red Tails, the fellows who finally ended up in the fighter units in Europe, give them a little ground instruction about flying in primary, because I had already gone through that phase in the civilian pilot training program. So that was my experience with a lot of fellows that I had previously been in college with. So that was quite an experience.
Well, and I want to focus on your story, but it strikes me that in that role as an instructor, and the people that this film, Red Tails, really focus on are the pilots, and you train some of these guys that are depicted in the film. Could you tell early on which guys you thought would have really bright futures and would be really capable of helping the war effort?
Well, you know, that was very difficult to ascertain. Most of the guys that I helped instruct did succeed, and I can think of a few exceptions. Well, under half of the people that begun, sometimes it was as few as one-third, finished and completed the training program. Most of them were eliminated in one of the phases of training. I guess more were eliminated, called washout, in primary than mm-hmm. the other two phases, but eventually only about anywhere from a third to a half of the ones who began completed their training.
What about the fact, and this is inescapable, the armed forces at this point are segregated. And I know you came from Pittsburgh, so you're well north of the Mason-Dixon line.
Yes.
Going down to Alabama, being part of a segregated unit, did that bother you at all? And did you notice a difference in the way things were in Alabama compared to the part of the country you had grown up in?
Oh, absolutely. It was going into a foreign country in many respects. Of course, I had experienced some facets of discrimination, segregation, right where I lived there in Pennsylvania, in mm-hmm. Sewickley, Pennsylvania. And I had been a man who fought for equality since I was knee-high to a duck. I highly resented all phases of discrimination and segregation. Even in our high school there, none of the blacks played on the basketball team. We had stars in football and track, and we were very welcome, but they tried to eliminate us from basketball even, not to speak of swim team, or we didn't have a pool in our high school, but we had one at the YMCA, which they used. YMCA just happened to be around the corner from where I resided. I could go over and play around a little touch football and stuff on the grounds, but couldn't go in the building of the YMCA. I resented all of that, and I happened to be, it was 106 in our graduating class. Six of us happened to be black, and three of the six were girls, and three were boys. And so I got them together and was able to persuade them to participate in the senior dance at the high school for the first time ever in history. Mm. When we walked on the floor of the affair that night, you could hear a pin drop across the floor. Everybody was shocked. You know? So I can't recall whether we were wearing tux or just blue suits, but we had to dance amongst ourselves, the boys, the three boys and three girls, and it was quite a fascinating affair. And I thought I had forever broken the line and set a precedent, but I learned later that it didn't last because it wasn't carried through the next year or the next. And I don't think it was many years before we participated in all the activities.
Well, I do know that there were other courageous stands you took later that would have lasting consequences, the famous Freeman Field Mutiny for one. We need to take a break, but more of 90-year-old Tuskegee Airman Mitch Higginbotham's trailblazing story when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ.
It's as simple as ABC, friends, no teeth.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 to the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll continue with 90-year-old Mitch Higginbotham. He lives in Dana Point, California. He was there as an honored guest for the Hollywood premiere of the movie Red Tails. He's actually seen it twice now, and he lived it. Well, it's an interpretive motion picture based on the true story of the Tuskegee Airmen. Our guest today was in Tuskegee, training many of the pilots those characters in the film were based on. But Mitch did not become a P-51 Mustang pilot. You got to fly a little bigger plane eventually.
I could have gone into the fighter program. Even had I done so, by that time it was late and they weren't taken into the combat group that went overseas in the Red Tails. 450 out of approximately 1,000 pilots went into combat.
Right.
I decided to join the bomber group, which had been effectuated much later, and I did so with the intention of being able to one day fly for the airlines. And I knew that having multi-engine experience would give me a big advantage. But
So this was the 477th Bomb Group with B-25s, right?
That's correct, yes. Uh-huh. And, of course, I must say, much to my despair, that efforts were all fruitless because it was many years later before the airlines would accept blacks as airline pilots.
Well, and it was also many years later that that we think of the civil rights movement. When we think civil rights movement, we think 1960s. But there's something that you and some of your fellow black officers did in 1945 that really, I think, was foundational to the civil rights movement. It all revolves around Freeman Field. Tell us about that incident.
Well, you put it quite accurately there when you say that. That is true. And our bomber training outfit started at Selfridge Field in Michigan. That's, Selfridge is about 40 miles out of Detroit. At that time, there had been a lot of unrest, racial unrest in the city of Detroit, and race riots had broken out all over Detroit and caused quite a crisis situation. The commanders at Selfridge Field was afraid that all was going to spill over into the military. They had segregated the officers' club there at Selfridge for white officers only, and blacks weren't permitted in the officers' club at Selfridge. Well, as a result of all this, the decision makers in Washington decided that we would had to leave the Detroit area, and there was a service field available called Godman Field in Louisville, Kentucky. It's adjacent to Fort Knox.
Right.
And it wasn't designed for that type of combat training at all. It was very insufficient, but that's where they relocated the 477th Bomb Group. And, of course, there wasn't a racial problem there because the little officers' club at Godman was, they were gladly relegated that to the black officers because the white personnel, officer personnel, could use the officers' club at Fort Knox, right, and it's approximately across the street. And so there was no problem there until when they found out how inadequate Godman Field, they decided to move the bomber group to Freeman Field near Seymour, Indiana, which is about 40-50 miles from Indianapolis. And we'd heard about some difficulties there in the officers' club. We had decided then that we couldn't tolerate that situation. And when we arrived there at Freeman, there was a group of some of our fellows thought that they would test entry to the officers' club. And, of course, the commander found out that this was anticipated, and he had designated the provost marshal to be there to see that his segregated orders were carried out. We had decided in pairs of threes or fours, we would go over to test the officers' club. And so that was where trouble began.
Well, you saw trouble coming, didn't you?
Yes, indeed, we did, really. We knew that it was going to be a confrontation, but didn't know what the nature of it would finally end up as. Commander Robert Selway, Colonel Robert Selway, then...
Who was white.
Yes, indeed, he was. And he, acting in collusion with his commander, I guess he was three or four-star general, Hunter was head of the entire 1st Air Force, which we were a part of.
Right.
So Selway ordered the fellows that went into the club there to be arrested. They were placed in house arrest for overnight and the next day. He got the situation formalized then, whereby all of us would be given an opportunity, being interviewed one at a time and being ordered directly to sign papers that we read and understood the orders and would abide by them.
So you basically had to promise not to go into the all-white officers' club again.
Well, it was more than a promise. It was a matter of being individually ordered
right.
not to use by our immediate commanding officer and read the articles of war regarding direct orders in time of warfare. And one section which was emphasized was that refusal to obey a direct order in time of warfare was punishable up to and including death. And, of course, death was emphasized.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the face of all that, 104 of us refused to sign. There was about, somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 black officers and maybe less than 100 white officers, maybe 85 or so. When the 104 of us refused to sign, General Hunter sent down, we were placed under arrest immediately.
Well, and I want to get into your mindset, because obviously there's strength in numbers, and if 104 of you are doing it, it's maybe a little easier than doing it all by yourself, but...
You hit on a good point there. The
but where does
on
that
the head, so to speak?
Where does that courage come from, though?
Well,
what made you decide I'm not going to sign this?
This is where the difficult situation arose, because we had no idea how many would refuse, and if only a dozen or a half dozen of us refused in the face of the Articles of War, then we would have been out on a limb all alone, and I'm sure that limb would have been sawed off.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happened that on principle, we absolutely refused, and not knowing how many would be in our group. If it had been only a few, then, of course, they would have thrown the book at us. But being over 100 black officers in the black newspapers across the country, and the Chicago Defender, Amsterdam News in New York, and the Pittsburgh Courier in Pittsburgh, which was the leading black newspaper, the Pittsburgh Courier, and that was read by white officers and then across some of our white officers as well. But they put pressure, and then we contacted the NAACP. Well, first we were flown back.
Well, and I want to get all that timeline, but I'm really interested in your personal decision to do this, knowing that they could throw the book at you, that anything could happen up to execution. But you had the courage to stand up and say, this is wrong, I'm not signing this. Where did that come from? How did you arrive at that decision?
Well, I was always incensed by this kind of action. And I was determined, you know, it was a matter of principles that I just couldn't stomach to be a part of something that where, in first place, ordering you to sign your name, I felt was illegal. I didn't know, you know, but I just, from what the education and whatnot that I had, I knew it wasn't right, and I was determined to go by principles and face the music, so to speak.
No matter what it meant, nothing scared you off.
Well, it didn't, and you look back, we were 20-year-old guys, 21, 20, 19, some of us, and just were determined that we wouldn't succumb to that sort of arrangement.
So they arrested you.
They arrested, and General Hunter sent down 3 C-47s, and they marched us down to the flight lines, and the enlisted men were observing and taking pictures of what was going on with their cameras, and most of the cameras were confiscated, but some of them got through, and they had pictures on the front page of the black newspapers liking the situation to Hitler's actions in Germany.
Mm.
And so I have some copies of the Pittsburgh Courier citing these pictures and citing in the headlines the Gestapo type of operations that was occurring at Freeman Field, Indiana.
Well, that's a pretty powerful comparison, given everything that people had heard about what was happening in Europe.
Indeed. And in our lockup, we contacted NAACP, and Thurgood Marshall was his of the legal department. The NAACP had agreed to represent us in a court-martial trial. So it was so much pressure. We had some influential black people, the professionals, the parents of many of us, and they applied pressure. The pressures exerted were sufficient to get a change, and they sent down a group of colonels from Washington to investigate the situation, and they investigated in Freeman, and they came down to Godman. We had a fellow named Coleman Young, who later became mayor of Detroit for four terms.
Yeah.
He was one of us, and he was maybe a year or two older than me, for instance. He had had some training as a labor leader in the auto workers union there in Detroit. So he had some kind of knowledge, and those kind of pressures eventually ended up in 101 of us being released with letters of reprimand placed in our files, reprimanding us for that type of disobedience. That remained on our records till 1995.
So for 50 years, even though you'd been released, you still had this...
still had the reprimand on our records of the 101. But the three that were court-martialed, Bill Terry, Marsden Thompson, and Shirley Clinton. Two of the fellows were found not guilty, I guess you'd call it, and one fellow was convicted in the court-martial.
And that was your roommate?
That was my roommate, Bill Terry. Bill Terry was convicted and fined $150, and he was eventually released. Of course, he'd been held in confinement for almost 3 months, as opposed to us being held for about 2 weeks.
And when he, in 1995, when the rest of you had those letters of reprimand pulled from your files, he received a full pardon, got his rank back, and he's got his $150 back, right?
Yes. That was down in Atlanta, Georgia. After Davis took over as commander, Benjamin O. Davis, the West Point commander of our Red Tails in Europe,
right,
he returned from Europe prior to the other Red Tails being brought back, and he was given command by Washington of the 477. We eventually ended up in Lockburn Air Base in Columbus, Ohio.
And you were hoping, I'm sure, to get over to the Pacific and actually fly some of those B-25s. But
well,
then,
we
the
anticipated
ended.
All that. Yes, of course. Of course, it was a hassle to get the bomber group together piecemeal, you know, because being trained in separate facilities around the air bases was a mammoth task, you know, because we had have a five-man crew on the bombers as opposed to just a one-man in the fighter planes. That was quite an operation to get those guys all trained and get them together. And finally, when they did so, we were all ready, and we had been accepted for combat by General MacArthur in the Pacific. We were scheduled to fly into Okinawa, and before we could get started, the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima.
Did you ever wonder, not that it matters in the grand scheme of things, but obviously with all the training you had gone through, the time that you'd spent in B-25s, I'm sure there was a desire on your part to put that training to use. And have you ever wondered in retrospect that if the incident at Freeman Field, the Freeman Field Mutiny as it's been called, if that had not occurred and taken the time that it did, that maybe you guys would have made it over in time to participate?
Absolutely, I think so. Yes, we should have been battle-trained and prepared to depart long before we were. There's no doubt that we would have got into the middle of the war in the Pacific had it not been for those kind of the delays.
But in retrospect, I'm guessing you probably feel that you 104 courageous guys had a greater impact with that act of what the military called insubordination, what you guys would have called civil disobedience.
Yes.
That the impact of that was far greater. Is that a fair statement to make?
I would suspect So on the eventual integration of the military, yes.
And that happened in 1948. So just 3 years later, President Truman integrated the armed forces, and probably in large part because of what you guys did.
That's a fair statement. In 1948, Truman, President Harry Truman, knew that he was running for re-election. Well, not re-election, he was running for election because he had assumed the presidency by virtue of the death of Franklin Roosevelt.
Correct.
He was facing a hard campaign with the revolt of the Dixiecrats. And Tom Dewey was the Attorney General of New York. He was predicted to win the presidency, and of course, you know the story.
Yeah, he was reported to have won the presidency. Yeah.
The headlines in some of the newspapers showed him as victor until all the returns were counted, and so Harry Truman needed all the votes he could get. So he issued the executive order integrating the military just prior to the election. And, of course, he got all the black support in that endeavor. We were under confinement, awaiting court-martial those 14 days at Godman Field, where we had previously been stationed.
Right.
We were returned there in these three airplanes, and we were met by armed guards at the airfield that we flew off of with a vehicle with bars on the windows, and we were taken back to where we had previously been living in the what they call the BOQs, Bachelor Officers Quarters. Huge floodlights had been installed all around the air. We weren't under lock and key, but floodlights were all over the area where we were housed, and guards were walking continuously, and the German prisoners of war were working in the areas, and they had much more freedom than we did at the time, which was something. We were under lockup in April of 1945 when Franklin Roosevelt died down in Warm Springs, Georgia, and Harry Truman became president and commander-in-chief, and I went in to tell my buddy Bill Terry, I said, gee, if you think we're in trouble now, the President Roosevelt is dead, and that little man from Missouri is now your commander-in-chief, and we may be hung, strung up as a result of all this. I told that story in an interview in 1999 in Las Vegas, Nevada, when we had a annual convention of the Tuskegee Airmen Incorporated, which we had formed in 1972 when we found out that we were being left out of history books and nobody knew anything about us. So we had to, as the old saying goes, we had to fight in the first place for the right to fight and show courage in battle and come back home and prove that we'd fought. So it was a three. And some books have been written, and that's it.
Well, I think it is pretty well proven now. And the movie Red Tails isn't going to hurt if there's anybody out there who still doesn't know. Time to hear from another of our sponsors right now. But when we come back, a lighthearted story from Tuskegee Airman Mitch Higginbotham and his final thoughts. This is Hometown Heroes on KMJ. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing's selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course, the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, Jennair, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We bring it in for a landing now with one-time bomber pilot, and really I think it's accurate to call him civil rights pioneer for his role in that Freeman Field mutiny we discussed. But enough of all that heavy stuff. Let's get a lighthearted story from 90-year-old Mitch Higginbotham. Go ahead. You are cleared for takeoff.
It was May 26th, Memorial Day, when I flew with the crew into Pittsburgh. I was determined to fly over Pittsburgh and Swickley.
Uh-huh.
So I came in over the Golden Triangle of Pittsburgh and down the Ohio River to Swickley, out over Swickley Heights. And you'd have to know something about Swickley was a bedroom community for Pittsburgh, and Swickley Heights was where the big steel magnates of Pittsburgh, like Andrew Carnegie and Andrew Mellon, all those guys had their mansions down Swickley Heights with estates all around, huge estates. Celebrities like that played golf out to Swickley Heights.
Sure.
And so later years, when Bob Hope became instrumental in helping our organization, I told this story to him as well, that I came down over Swickley Heights in the golf course, and low enough in the B-25 bomber, which makes a huge noise down to low level, and frightened the people, golfers. They were diving under the trees, and then down over my home in the village of Swickley, and down over the YMCA, which was around the corner, and then finally up in the air and down over the main street, Beaver Street, and disrupted the parade. So the city fathers were up in arms, calling all over the place, trying to find out who was in the air. The few black folks in the town knew who it was, I think. And so I was lucky enough not to get caught, because they would throw the book at you at that time for that kind of stuff, because if people had gotten killed too many instances.
Sure, yeah, and you'd been down that road. With all this coming back around now, the movie Red Tails, you've seen it a couple times already. Mm-hmm. You've been
and
to Washington.
I got some credit, too, by the way. My name's at the end of where they give credits to.
Exactly. I hope everybody looks for you.
I'm very happy about that.
I hope when everyone sees the film, they look for your name in the credits.
Okay,
at the end.
Very well. And
But I want to ask you, now, so you've met the President of the United States. You've gotten the Congressional Gold Medal. You've been through a lot over all these years.
Yes.
But now to have this movie out, what does it mean to you, and what do you hope it accomplishes?
Well, I hope it exposes us more to the people around the world, and especially in the United States, and especially with the younger kids that we try to groom, and we've got all kinds of scholarship funds. As a national, we give $75,000 a year in scholarships to any student, black or white, male or female, and we've given away well over $500,000 already. I'm hoping that it inspires people, as in a smaller way, the HBO movie with Lawrence Fishburne back in '95 did. But this to do on a far wider scale, you know. George Lucas is a lovely guy. I've been knowing him for 20 years since he first contracted to do a movie. And he later got bogged down in Star Wars 1 and 2 and so forth and so on. But now he's finally got it made. And it's been, I'm very tickled.
When you look back on your own career, and you eventually became a probation officer in Los Angeles and did that for a long time, and you're 90, almost 91 years old now, so a lot to look back on. But what do you look back on and feel the most pride about?
I feel great about learning to fly, and that was the inspiration for most of us. We didn't set out to be any martyrs or any change in history or anything else. The primary factor for the great majority There was 996 pilots that graduated finally and became flying officers. It just happened that we be going in history as being a part of all of this. But that was far from we didn't have any idea of any entertaining anything like that. We wanted to fly, and most of us are inspired by the thrill of being in the air, like most of the white pilots were. But, you know, when I went in 1942, you had to be at least 2 years of college. In 1944, when my brother, who was 5 years younger than I, went in, so many pilots had been killed in Europe and Pacific, that they wanted pilots badly enough that they'd take them right out of high school. My brother came out, and 2 weeks later, he's down in Mississippi and on his way to Tuskegee, Alabama.
Yeah, and so you and your brother both have a piece of this history. And
yeah,
I wanna...
my brother didn't finish training, but he later became a doctor and went back in on a GI Bill and became a medical doctor and the first lieutenant in the medical part of the military. Later, and became the first black intern in the Swickley Hospital. And so now he's an orthopedic surgeon, just retired at age 85, just retired finally last month, December.
Well, obviously, your family has a lot of accomplishments to be proud of, and I want to go back now. It just occurred to me at the start of our interview, you mentioned that your father and yourself, that you both went before the draft board on the same day, that
yeah,
your father
was
drafted
funny.
As white and you as black. I bet some of our listeners are wondering what your father ended up doing for the war effort.
You know, he was three or four of his brothers were in World War One,
mm-hmm.
And he was a little bit too young. He's the youngest of a number of brothers. And then he was just on the borderline of being too old for World War II. He ended up getting a deferment because he became a welder in the shipyards of the Drevol shipyards. We were making ships there. And he'd worked in the steel mills, you know. And so he worked in the shipyards there all during the war. So he's 19 years older than myself, so he died at age 72.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Well, I just wanted to put the period on the end of that sentence there for you.
Okay, very well.
Well, on behalf of all our listeners, I just want to thank you for serving our country. Thank you for having the courage to stand up for what was right. And I know that there are generations of Americans who have you and all those other men to thank for that. So thanks a lot.
Well, you say it very well, and I appreciate your calling and discussing it with me.
My pleasure and my privilege, no doubt. That is 90-year-old Mitch Higginbotham, an original Tuskegee Airman now living down in Orange County. For more information on his story, the Tuskegee Airmen in general, or, of course, that film Red Tails, visit our website, kmjnow.com. And join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.